Okay, so let's unpack this. Picture this.
Right.
You're a law student, right? And you're faced with a loan agreement that's really gone sideways. We're talking a big amount, like $7.5 million.
Yeah.
But it's not straightforward.
No, definitely not.
There's a letter of credit involved, a whole consortium of banks, I think, what, 44 of them? And then, just to make it interesting, a bankruptcy completely messes things up.
Right.
The borrower defaults. Now, here's the million-dollar question. Well, the $7.5 million question. Can the bank that issued that letter of credit actually sue the borrower directly, even though they weren't the original lender? It sounds like a real tangled web.
It is. It really is. And, you know, it's precisely these kinds of complex financial situations that you as future transactional lawyers are going to run into. What's helpful here is we have a key case that sort of shines a light on this. JPMorgan Chase Bank v. Cook from back in 2004. This case is a fantastic deep dive into equitable subrogation, especially under New York UCC Section 5117. It's a really prime example of how courts figure out liability when you've got all these layers in a lending deal.
Okay, so let's try and untangle that web a bit. Who are the main players here? We've got Roderick Cook. He was an executive at Global Crossing.
Right.
Then there's JPMorgan Chase Bank.
Yeah.
But they seem to be wearing a couple of different hats. They issued the letter of credit, and they were the administrative agent for this big group of 44 banks.
That's correct.
And then, just to add another layer, the actual original lender for Cook's $7.5 million loan was JPMorgan's private bank division. See? It gets complicated fast.
Absolutely. And if we kind of zoom out and look at the whole financial structure, there are basically three layers, right? First, you've got Cook's basic promise to repay the $7.5 million to the private bank. That's the promissory note. Simple enough. Second, to secure that loan, the main JPMorgan Chase Bank, the big entity, issued this letter of credit. Now, this wasn't just floating out there. It was backed by this huge $1 billion credit line that Global Crossing had set up with those 44 banks. And JPMorgan, yeah, they were acting as the administrative agent, sort of managing that whole big pool of money for the group of lenders in their deal with Global Crossing. Think of them as the point person.
So kind of managing the overall relationship between the 44 banks and Global Crossing.
Exactly. But the court, interestingly, focused more on JPMorgan's specific role guaranteeing Cook's loan rather than getting too bogged down in the mechanics of that larger facility.
Got it. So it's like a series of safety nets, and then there's a third piece, right? Cook also pledged collateral.
Yes. He put up about 2.5 million shares of Global Crossing stock as collateral for his loan. Plus, he had the separate side deal, an agreement with Global Crossing itself, promising to pay them back if that letter of credit ever got drawn on. So lots of interconnected promises.
Wow. Okay. Lots of moving parts.
Definitely. And what really set this whole legal fight in motion was, the big one. Global Crossing declared bankruptcy.
Ah, there it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And as you can imagine, that sent shockwaves through this whole setup. Cook ended up defaulting on his $7.5 million loan. And because of that default, JPMorgan Chase Bank, the issuer, had to step up and pay out the $7.5 million under the letter of credit. They paid it to their own private bank division, the original lender.
Okay.
But here's the kicker. Because Global Crossing was bankrupt, JPMorgan couldn't then turn around and recover that money from Global Crossing, which might have been the original expectation. They were stuck.
Right. So JPMorgan's out $7.5 million, can't get it from the bankrupt Global Crossing. So that brings us right back to that central legal question. Could JPMorgan, wearing its letter of credit issuer's hat, sue Cook directly for the money, even though the private bank division was the original lender?
Exactly. And this is where that concept, equitable subrogation, becomes absolutely critical.
Okay. Tell us about that. And the UCC section.
Right. So New York UCC Section 5117 is key here. This law basically writes down, codifies the rule of statutory subrogation specifically for letter of credit issuers. In simply terms, when JPMorgan paid out on that letter of credit, the law allowed them to essentially step into the legal shoes of the party they paid the beneficiary, which was the private bank.
Ah, okay.
So they inherit the rights the private bank originally had against Cook.
So for everyone listening, maybe think of it like this. Mm-hmm. If someone guarantees your loan and you default and they have to pay it off, the law might say, okay, guarantor, you now have the right to go after the original borrower directly to get your money back.
Yeah.
That's kind of the gist of subrogation. Like the court said, substitution of one person for another, standing in their shoes.
That's a great way to put it. It's all about who ultimately has to bear the loss for that debt.
Makes sense.
Now, Cook, understandably, didn't just roll over. He fought back with several legal arguments trying to stop JPMorgan from coming after him. One of his biggest arguments was this idea of double recovery. He basically said, hey, JP Morgan, you guys were managing that huge $1 billion credit facility for Global Crossing. You probably already got reimbursed, or should have, from that pot of money. You shouldn't get to collect from me, too.
Okay, that sounds plausible on the surface. What else?
He also had a procedural objection. He argued he wasn't given a fair chance to gather evidence about what everyone involved intended when they set up this whole loan guarantee program. Like, what were their expectations about repayment?
He thought maybe digging into that might show JP Morgan wasn't supposed to sue him directly.
That seemed to be his hope, yes. And finally, he disputed the prejudgment interest. He argued, look, my agreement was to pay back Global Crossing if the letter of credit was used, not JP Morgan directly. So why should I owe interest to JP Morgan all the way back to when I first defaulted on the loan? My obligation to JP Morgan only started when they paid.
Okay, so three distinct arguments. No double recovery, need more discovery on intent, and the interest calculation was wrong. But the court didn't buy them.
Nope, the court rejected all three. Let's take the subrogation and double recovery point first. The court was really clear here. They said, look, that letter of credit, it was fundamentally a guarantee of Cook's debt to the private bank. Simple as that.
Cool.
Because JP Morgan issued that guarantee, they became a secondary obligor. And under that New York law, UCC section 5117, once they paid up, they got the statutory right to sue Cook. The court really emphasized looking at the economic reality of the whole thing, not just the fancy labels on the contract.
So substance over form.
Exactly. The fact that there were these complex internal banking arrangements regarding Global Crossing's billion-dollar facility didn't just magically erase Cook's personal debt. And critically, the court said, hey, there's no double recovery here because Cook hadn't paid anyone back the $7.5 million. Not the private bank, not JP Morgan, not Global Crossing. The debt was still outstanding.
That's a really important point for law students, isn't it? Don't get lost in the complex structure. Find the core obligation. Has the money actually been repaid?
Absolutely. Courts will often cut through the layers like that.
Okay, so that deals with double recovery.
Mm-hmm.
What about his argument about needing more discovery on the party's intentions?
The court wasn't moved by that either. They essentially said, look, even if Cook's understanding of everyone's intentions was correct, it wouldn't change the clear words in the loan documents he signed. And it wouldn't change how subrogation law works. The law gives JP Morgan this right, regardless of what Cook thought might happen. Further discovery wasn't going to change that fundamental legal reality.
So the unambiguous contract language and the statute were paramount. Makes sense. And the prejudgment interest argument.
Yeah, on that one, the court's logic was pretty straightforward. They said Cook had the benefit of using that $7.5 million from the moment he defaulted. He had the money.
Right.
So regardless of who he expected to eventually repay, he was benefiting from holding onto funds that weren't rightfully his after the default. Therefore, awarding interest to JP Morgan from the default date was fair compensation for that delay.
Okay, so the court comprehensively dismantled Cook's defenses. This case really seems to cement some important principles for anyone going into transactional law.
It really does. For you future transactional lawyers, what's fascinating is how this ruling validates these complex multi-lender deals, like syndicated loans where you might see letters of credit used as guarantees. It shows courts are willing to look past the formal structure, you know, the labels, and focus on the substance, who really took on the risk. What are the actual economic consequences here?
And didn't the court also touch on broader policy, something about encouraging these kinds of deals?
Yes, exactly. The court explicitly noted that denying subrogation in cases like this could actually discourage banks from participating in these commercially beneficial loan participation agreements.
Oh.
They saw that allowing subrogation helps keep the wheels of commerce turning in these complex lending scenarios. And it also reinforces that really basic point. The guarantor going bankrupt, like Global Crossing did, doesn't let the primary borrower, Cook, off the hook. His obligation remained.
So if our listeners are trying to boil this down for, say, an exam or just to remember the core principle, is there like a quick checklist or test from the Cook case?
Yeah, I think you could frame it like this based on the court's reasoning. Three key things. One, did the letter of credit issuer JP Morgan actually pay out after the borrower Cook defaulted? Yes, they did.
Okay.
Two, did that letter of credit really function as a guarantee of the underlying loan, making the issuer a secondary obligor? The court said yes, it did.
Right.
And three, does allowing subrogation, letting the issuer step into the lender's shoes, align with the purpose of UCC Section 5117 and the overall economic reality? Again, the court found it did. If you tick those boxes, subrogation is probably going to be allowed.
That's a really helpful framework. Now, there are a couple of other, maybe finer points. What about J.P. Morgan's dual role? They issued the LOC, but they were also the agent for the 44 banks in the big Global Crossing facility. Did the court worry about a conflict there?
That's a great question, and yeah, it's an important nuance. The court specifically looked at that dual role, but ultimately they decided it wasn't a conflict that prevented J.P. Morgan from exercising its subrogation rights against Cook. They essentially treated J.P. Morgan's role managing the big facility for Global Crossing as separate from its specific role as the guarantor of Cook's personal loan.
So two different hats, legally speaking.
Pretty much. The duties owed to the banking syndicate didn't cancel out the rights gained by guaranteeing and paying Cook's debt.
Okay, that clarifies that. And you mentioned earlier how letters of credit are often used in trade finance, but here it was more like a loan guarantee.
Right, and that just shows how flexible these financial instruments can be. You know, you usually think of LOCs ensuring payment when goods cross borders. But here, it was adapted for a domestic loan situation, essentially acting as a backup promise to pay if the primary borrower defaulted. The core function, the issuer's commitment to pay, is the same, but the application is different.
Interesting. And just quickly, that side agreement Cook had with Global Crossing to pay them back, why did that become irrelevant?
Simply because Global Crossing went bankrupt. Once they were insolvent, Cook's promise to reimburse them didn't really matter anymore. There was no solvent entity for him to pay back under that specific agreement. Mm. It didn't erase his original debt to the private bank, the obligation that J.P. Morgan ultimately inherited through subrogation. The bankruptcy changed the practicalities, but not the underlying debt.
Got it. So bringing this all together for our listeners, especially those law students wading through case law, what's the bottom line from J.P. Morgan v. Cook?
Well, the bottom line is pretty clear. Roderick Cook borrowed a lot of money. He defaulted. And the court essentially said, sorry, even though this was a super complicated setup with letters of credit and multiple banks, that doesn't create a loophole for you to avoid repaying your debt.
No escaping the fundamental obligation.
Yeah, exactly.
So as we wrap up, what's that final thought, that key piece of wisdom from this case that our listeners should really take away as they continue studying law?
I think the crucial takeaway is this. In complex financial deals, always, always dig beneath the surface structure. Yes, understand the contracts, understand the instruments like letters of credit, but don't stop there. Ask, what's the underlying economic reality? Who really benefited? Who took on the risk? What was the core purpose? The court here showed that those substantive questions often trump intricate structural arguments. Grasping that principle, looking for the substance, will serve you incredibly well, not just with LOCs, but across pretty much all of commercial law.